Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Hey, good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, and we've got 2 hours in front of us talking about the things that matter most. Many of you may have heard that there's a new film that premiered in Rome yesterday called Francesco. And from what I've been able to learn, since I haven't seen the film myself, it focuses on some of Pope Francis's favorite issues. However, some reports are coming in that during the film, Pope Francis came out in support of same-sex civil unions. Sometimes they're called domestic partnerships. I want to talk about this because there is an extraordinary amount of misinformation circulating in the secular press. And this is one of the reasons Catholic radio exists, and that is to show a measure of competence in dealing with Catholic matters that the secular press seems allergic to. So, that's coming up in the first segment of today's program. Also, we're going to take time to speak with Gerard Verschuren, geneticist, who will point out how science can, in fact, lead us to God. No longer this lie that science and faith are incompatible. Also, Raymond Arroyo joins us in the second hour of today's program with a really fun story about, an animal that was there at the nativity, but it wasn't a sheep, it wasn't a cow, it wasn't another barn animal, it was a spider. We'll talk about the spider who saved Christmas. Also, going to get a bit of an education here about Blessed Charles I of Austria. His feast is October 21st. He's known by other names due to successions in the Habsburg monarchy, but he's a fascinating guy. And we're going to talk with Charles Cullum about him. So stay with me. Right now, the news.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon. I'm Matthew Hambler with your Ave Maria Radio News headlines for Wednesday, October 21st. It's the Feast of Blessed Charles of Austria. The news this hour is sponsored by Visiting Angels, providing loving care to seniors in need. More info at visitingangels.com. The Justice Department is announcing a settlement with a major pharmaceutical company involving OxyContin and the opioid epidemic.
The Department of Justice is announcing a global resolution of our criminal and civil investigations into the opioid manufacturer Purdue Pharma.
Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen said Purdue Pharma has agreed to plead guilty to 3 federal criminal charges and will pay roughly $8 billion in fines. Purdue has been blamed for helping to unleash the epidemic. A Maryland man is in federal custody for threatening to kidnap and kill Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris. James Dale Reed is accused of leaving a graphic and threatening note at a Frederick, Maryland home where a Biden-Harris campaign sign was in the yard. Home surveillance video captured the image of the man. He was reportedly on the Secret Service's radar after threatening a person under Secret Service protection in 2014. The Senate Republican stimulus bill isn't getting the support it needs to advance. A party-line vote spelled doom for the measure worth $500 billion. The measure needed 60 votes to move forward, but only got 51. This comes as House Democrats are trying to work out a deal with the White House. In a sign of the times, Mississippi voters will be allowed to vote curbside in the general election. Residents who have tested positive for COVID-19 or who have been exposed to the virus are eligible. The decision follows a federal court lawsuit aimed at easing voting restrictions. The Los Angeles Dodgers beat the Tampa Bay Rays last night in the first game of the World Series. The score was 8-3. Game 2 airs tonight at 8 on Fox. With your Ave Maria Radio News headlines, I'm Matthew Hamblin.
Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Al Cresta, and a little surprised by some news that came up today. Last night, or yesterday sometime, a new film entitled Francesco premiered in Rome. It tells the story of Jorge Mario Bergoglio and tackles some of the main themes of Pope Francis's pontificate through a series of interviews. And I haven't seen the film. So I'm relying on published reports here. I want to make that clear. But, you know, it sounds like a lot of it is what you would expect. Pope Francis speaking about outreach to marginalized peoples of the world. Climate change is involved. Increased role of women in the church. Some media outlets are seizing a political dimension to the film. Apparently, in discussing immigration, he condemned President Trump's child separation policy at the U.S.-Mexico border, which he called, quote, cruelty of the highest form, end quote. But there's another side of the story that's getting the most emphasis and causing unnecessary confusion. Many will be surprised that Pope Francis has been a supporter of civil unions for homosexuals. Now, rest assured, this will be greatly misunderstood. And why do I say that? Because it is being misunderstood. One of our wire service stories that came in today puts it this way. Pope Francis says he believes same-sex couples should be allowed to get married. End quote. I'll tell you, this highlights the need for Catholic radio. As I've said over and over again over the years, the secular press just doesn't get our story. They're frankly ignorant of what the Catholic Church actually teaches, and important distinctions are lost on them. Civil unions and marriage are not the same. In fact, this was not news so much as history. Pope Francis, when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, valiantly fought same-sex marriage. He called same-sex marriage legislation a destructive attack on God's plan. In a book, he wrote that laws that assimilated homosexual relationships to marriage are an anthropological regression, a step backwards. And he expressed concern that if same-sex couples are given adoption rights, there could be affected children. Every person, he needs a male father and a female mother. And that is necessary to help shape their identity. In fact, he was accused, so strong was he, in opposing same-sex marriage, that he was accused by the president of Argentina of holding attitudes reminiscent of medieval times and the Inquisition. Now, he did apparently propose civil unions for homosexual couples as a legal category. He was not supporting sexual relations between or unchaste behavior between homosexual couples. Pope Francis has made the very point that he has oftentimes been a spiritual director to and a guide to many people who are dealing with same-sex attraction. And he believes that people who find themselves burdened with same-sex attraction can find some degree of friendship, accountability, and non-sexual intimacy by entering into civil unions. He stresses this is not marriage. This is not a license to engage in unchaste behavior. These civil unions would authorize, though, a series of civil rights for the couple so that a designated partner could inherit. They could have a right to hospital visitations. And again, while he was Cardinal Bergoglio, he was clear that he did not approve of same-sex marriage or adoption to same-sex couples. I think it's fair to say, from all we know about Pope Francis, that he's trying to make it clear that we are not to shun people who are dealing with same-sex attraction. He wants us to be welcoming and accompanying. But at no time have I heard him suggest that we should be tolerant of unchaste behavior among same-sex people than we are with heterosexual people. Unchaste behavior remains a problem. So you're going to hear people saying that Pope Francis is somehow setting the stage for same-sex marriage. All I can say is that's not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen. Unfortunately, when these issues get reported in the mainstream press, they're reported as part of an ongoing narrative, which underlies a lot of modern reporting. And the underlying narrative, the underlying story, is the idea of, quote, we are making progress, we are evolving towards fuller acceptance of one another and increased liberty to do as we wish, liberty to remake the world as we see fit. You know, I was talking to Matthew Bunsen off the air earlier today about this story, and he made the point that the secular press actually envisions a future. When they think about where this story is going, they're thinking that there's going to be a future in which a Cardinal Jolene of Chicago is sitting happily at a pro-choice rally with her husband, Geraldine, and with their children who were conceived in vitro. This is the end game. Full acceptance of abortion rights, full acceptance of same-sex so-called marriage, full acceptance of artificial reproduction. And actually, they might even get rid of the idea of a cardinal because they don't like hierarchical formats. Those of us who see this going on know that this is actually going to undermine human dignity. It's not going to lead to human flourishing. Now, unfortunately, at this time, the Vatican hasn't yet published a clarification, and I'm not sure they ever will. Pope Francis tends not to clarify on matters of this sort. I should also mention that the Vatican press notice on this film doesn't even mention same-sex civil unions. Clearly, these kind of comments are not to be received even as magisterial teaching. If Pope Francis wants to teach, he can publish an encyclical or some other document. But for right now, we shouldn't read too much into this incident. I realize it's troubling because when you don't clarify and leave these statements out there, they will breed misunderstanding. And I have to say, this is one of the problems that I've had with this pontificate. It's not that I don't have a low opinion of the papacy, or that, let me put it this way. Look, Pope Francis himself told one of the reporters from the New York Times back, I think in March. He says, criticisms always help. I can critique myself. I like this. I do not like it when critics are coming under the table. They smile, they let you see their teeth, and then they stab you in the back. This is not loyal. This is not human. Criticism is to be welcomed as constructive. So he likes a fair criticism. He says it will always be well received, at least by me. So I do. I have a criticism. And that is, as one of the sheep of the flock here, I am bleating, B-L-E-A-T-I-N-G. I am bleating. This causes confusion. Without further explanation, these kind of things cause confusion. They breed misunderstanding. So there are a few things that we know. Number one, there's going to be the misunderstanding as a result of this story. Second, the church will not, absolutely will not be changing its teaching on the sacrament of marriage or the morality of sexual acts outside marriage. That would be an impossible task, overturning scripture, overturning centuries of coherent and cohesive sacramental teaching. It would destroy our understanding of the human person, the nature of the fall, the theology of the body. Third, we have to respect, of course, the office of the papacy. It's a great blessing to us. And realize at the same time that each pope brings to it a certain style, a certain history, a certain language, a certain grammar, a certain syntax. And Pope Francis's style is definitely more casual than Benedict XVI. And he knows, and we should know, that his casual remarks don't have the force of magisterial teaching. Jesus remains head of the church. He's there in heaven. We, his body on the earth here, oftentimes fail to reflect his will. And that's true of popes as well. Popes, as we see right in Galatians chapter 2, right on the pages of the New Testament, we see that St. Paul had to rebuke our first pope, Peter, because he wasn't living in accord with the gospel. I see this kind of, I think this is careless. Now, he may think otherwise, but I do think it, just from people, I heard from so many people already today that are worried and confused. I also think it plays into the hands of those theologians and certain priests, and at least one bishop I know, who I think would want to push the boundaries and say that this is a matter of conscience, not a matter of objective moral teaching, but simply a matter of conscience. This, they'll never win on this, but they will cause a lot of confusion. And a lot of people's salvation will be imperiled because they will not teach the clear message of the scriptures and the tradition of the Catholic Church, which is that sexual relations are to be limited to heterosexual marriage, marriage which is defined by a commitment to permanence, to the expectation and education of children. So this is what we have to keep in mind. This is going to create misunderstanding. The church is not changing its teaching on this. And thirdly, we must respect the office of the papacy, even if we're well aware that any particular person who is our present pope is not going to be a perfect person. Our teaching on infallibility doesn't mean that he always says the right thing at the right time in the right way. And I think we've had problems like this before. I think we have to always keep in mind from Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. Just listen to this. This puts it in perspective. If you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. That day will come, and it may be sooner than we realize. But right now, you know, let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in Jesus.
What is catechesis, and why do we care? The job of catechesis is to reveal all the joy as well as the demands of the way of Christ, says the Catholic Catechism. The way of Christ is summed up in the catechesis of the Beatitudes. Jesus gave us the 8 Beatitudes in his Sermon on the Mount. The Catholic Catechism tells us this teaching is the only path that leads to the eternal beatitude, happiness, for which the human heart longs. The catechesis of sin and forgiveness challenges us. Unless man acknowledges that he is a sinner, states the Catechism, he cannot know the truth about himself, which is a condition for acting justly, and without the offer of forgiveness, man could not bear the truth. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Is your teen struggling with self-criticism, poor motivation, or bad eating or sleeping habits? Does he or she tend to isolate, have bouts of anger, or struggle in their academic or social life? If you've said yes to at least a few of these statements, your teen might be dealing with clinical depression. According to Johns Hopkins University, adolescent depression rates increased by 37% in the last decade. Many parents assume that depressed mood and behavior are a normal part of a teenager's life. While every teen has some struggles with self-image or peer relationships, when those struggles become a consistent cross, it's time to seek professional help. Depression isn't something your kids will grow out of, but with appropriate help, it is something they can learn to leave behind for good. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the support of MVP Realty Associates, helping people find homes in the town of Ave Maria, Florida. The town of Ave Maria has a water park, golf courses, restaurants, medical and retail stores, and is located 20 minutes from Naples. New construction and resale homes are available. More information about the town of Ave Maria and the vision of Domino's Pizza founder Tom Monahan is available from Greg Musumano at 239-825-6958.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. There are certain lies that become embedded within the consciousness of societies and cultures. One of those lies is that science and religion, or science and faith, or in particular science and Christian faith, are somehow incompatible. That there's this historic warfare between science and Christian faith. Historians of science have don't really hold to this any longer. There was, during a period of time in the 19th century, there was some well-known, celebrated people who tried to make this point. But really, if you talk to historians of science today, they don't buy it. In fact, there's a whole chapter in Dangers to the Faith where I deal with this. But it doesn't die. Popular culture continues to keep alive this idea that science and faith are incompatible. My guest is Dr. Gerard Verschuren. He's been with us before. He is the author of many books, including How Science Points to God, which is going to be our focus today. He's a scientist. He's a writer, speaker, a consultant. He's been working at this interface of science and religion, creation and evolution, faith and reason, for a long time. By training, he's a biologist. He has studied, worked at universities in Europe and the United States, and he's the author of books, A Catholic Scientist Proves God Exists, Matters of Life and Death, A Catholic Guide to the Moral Questions of Our Time, and today we're talking about his book, How Science Points to God. Dr. Verschuren, thanks for joining me. It's good to have you again.
Thank you, Al, for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, let's start with the whole scientific enterprise itself. It's been said by many historians of science that science rests upon assumptions that really emerge from a Christian understanding of life. The idea that there's a rational God who's created a rational universe, and creatures in his own image who can understand this. Talk to us about how science itself, the enterprise itself, is dependent upon our understanding of God.
Yes, as you said correctly, science has assumptions. Most scientists don't want to hear about that, so they ignore it. But you can't stay silent for the rest of your life about it.
Right.
So there must be something with those assumptions. And in my book, I talk about at least five of them. One of them is that there is an objectively real world. Otherwise, science is just a matter of fiction if there is no real world.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is comprehensible.
Yes.
Even Albert Einstein said that. Otherwise, science would not be possible. If we cannot comprehend the world because it is chaos or we can't understand it, then there is no science possible. Mm-hmm. And also that our perception through eyes, ears, and hands is in essence reliable. Otherwise, science is not reliable.
Right.
And I think there is order in nature.
Mm-hmm.
The sun will rise every morning, though we may not always see it. It will arise. We don't have to be surprised every morning that the sun is there again. So science has to accept that. Science can prove quite a bit, but I'm very skeptical how much it can prove.
Mm-hmm.
But it can never prove its own assumptions. It has to assume them before science can even get off the ground.
Yes.
That is a clear indication, I would say, that it points to God. For where does that come from, that real world? Where do the laws of nature come from? Did they just pop up? That's hard to believe. That is magic.
Right.
And there is nothing magic in this world. So we have to say to everyone, and you talked in the beginning about the warfare, the lie, the myth, that there is a clash between science and religion. Well, we need that religion in order to let science even get started.
Exactly.
In the 15th, 16th century, almost all scientists were religious believers.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, when I tell people that I am a human geneticist and a believer, they look at me like, are you right? Is that possible? They see a conflict, and I keep saying there is no conflict. It's actually a very harmonious relationship. I sometimes call it a match made in heaven.
Yes.
We need religion in order to do science. Science can do a lot, but it cannot prove its own assumptions. That is a long answer to a short question.
No, very good. You write about the physical constants in our universe. What are these physical constants, and how do they point to God?
Oh, I find them very important and very powerful. We have four basic forces in nature: gravity, electromagnetism, weak nuclear interactions, and strong nuclear interactions. Where do those forces come from? If they were slightly different, I prove in my book that a lot of things in this world would be very different and some would not even be possible. If the strength of gravity, for instance, were not based on the inverse square of the distance, sorry for that technical language, then the orbits of the planets in the solar system would be much more complicated than ellipses. Or circles, as some say, but it's really a matter of ellipses. And otherwise, our solar system would collapse, basically. So we need that gravity law. It's a law of nature. And the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force, as if they would have been a little different, the universe would have had a very different outcome. And probably we would not be on this Earth. There would not be human life. Of course, scientists say that's a matter of coincidence. And they come up with all kind of explanations, like Hawkins. He died not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was a famous astrophysicist. But he came up with a weird explanation. He said there must have been multiple universes.
Yeah.
And one of them happens to be the one that we can live in.
Yeah.
Well, where does that idea come from? From Hawkins.
Right, right.
He found it out on his own. But there is no... How can you prove that there are multiple universes? That is impossible. You cannot step outside your own universe. He does so happily because he is a good physicist but not a great philosopher. So I would rather refer to the Book of Wisdom that says, God, you have arranged all things by measure and number and weight. And the physical constants have been arranged by God according to that measure, to that number, and that weight. And that's why we can exist in this universe. You, again, that was a little bit technical, but your audience can handle that easily.
I'm sure. This, how unlikely is it that there would be a life-affirming universe or a life-possible universe? It's not very likely, right?
I don't find it very likely, and because it requires a lot of conditions.
Right.
And, and for those conditions to be found, Hawking would say, oh, yeah, find one in another planet, in another solar system or whatever. But why? Why do we need all of that?
Right.
We have to realize that everything on Earth is ruled by laws of nature. And those laws of nature, yeah, there we go again, where do they come from? They didn't just pop up. They came from God. And thanks to those laws of nature, certain things are possible and certain things are not possible. So we can say on this planet that there are certain laws that have to be fulfilled. So there must be something on this Earth that causes that. There is a famous periodic system that regulates everything from the from helium through uranium, all the 92 elements that we find on this world. That is a very strict system. Certain combinations of molecules are not possible. Certain compounds are not possible. And some are very likely, thanks to the periodic system. So I would say, when we go through, if I may jump to the issue of evolution, evolution was not just a haphazard event.
Right.
It works, as some say, with natural selection. Whether you believe that or not, even if you believe that, natural selection does not work haphazardly. It has to select what is successful. And things that are not really successful on this Earth will not make it in evolution. And so that's why I say that we have to follow those laws. A heart that does not follow hydrodynamic laws for pumping blood cannot be very successful. And, fish that don't follow hydrodynamic laws, or birds that don't follow laws of movement, they cannot be successful. So the path of evolution is not as weird as some people think. It follows, I always like to use that image, it follows a path of least resistance. Some things are very unlikely, have a high resistance, so the river cannot follow a path of high resistance. Water will never flow upwards.
Right.
So it has to follow the topographic design of the landscape, and so does the stream of evolution. It follows a path somehow regulated by the laws of nature and the design of the universe. Where does that design come from? You feel it coming.
Yeah.
From the Creator.
Right, yeah.
He made everything possible. He designed the bed in which the stream of evolution meanders. So, is it random? Not really. And besides, randomness is something that we have to be very careful with. I always refer to Padre Pio, who always used to say, everyone who says that something is a matter of coincidence, I always ask, whom do you think regulated that coincidence?
Right, yes.
It's God.
Yes.
It's God. And even Thomas Aquinas, our famous philosopher in the Catholic Church, he said, everyone who only believes in randomness, in chance, is not really a believer.
Yes,
so,
right.
I always protest when I hear scientists say, oh, that is randomness. But of course, they have the right to say that as a scientist, but as long as they don't claim that that's the final truth.
That's the final, that's right, that's the final controlling element. Dr. Verschuren, hold it there. We'll take a break. We'll come right back and look at the Big Bang.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Religious freedom and healthcare and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
Vatican II teaches that every baptized person is a participant in the threefold office of Jesus, which is priest, prophet, and king. So as priest, Christ is a sanctifier. He effects a reconciliation between divinity and humanity, right, by his great sacrifice on the cross. Every baptized person does indeed participate in that, in the measure that we all have that calling to reconcile divinity and humanity, to bring God to people and people to God. That's true of every baptized person. Vatican II further specifies that the ordained priesthood is different, not only in degree, but in kind. And it has to do with the identification between the ordained priest, I think, and the Mass, and a unique relationship to the sacraments. Every baptized person has a task of reconciling divinity and humanity. The ordained priest does it in this sort of heightened sacramental and Eucharistic way.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I've got to vent. Is this so? It's old theory. Somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Gerard Verschuren, author most recently of How Science Points to God. We've been looking at various aspects of the scientific enterprise, certain discoveries of science. And let's go to one which is relatively new in terms of discovery of the middle of the 20th century, the idea of the Big Bang. You've heard the the idea that there's this big bang. You may even know that a Catholic priest had an essential role in helping to discover and confirm it. He was a Belgian priest, astronomer, and physicist, Father George Lemaître, at Catholic University of Louvain. When I was still in college, this hadn't been quite settled, at least according to my undergraduate physics teacher, who still thought there was something to be said for what used to be called the steady state theory of the universe. And Dr. Verschuren, let me ask you, when was the Big Bang finally, when did it finally reach, become dominant in the minds of astrophysicists?
It, as you said, it's rather recent, but the weird thing is that the term Big Bang came from Fred Hoyle.
Huh,
he was
okay.
a firm atheist, and he mocked at it by applying that name. It was not a compliment. He just said, oh, that's the Big Bang, because he was really a guy who believed in a steady state.
Right, right.
Where came that idea come from? Basically from Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, and he is not the first one in physics, he is a famous one, so I'm very careful to blame Einstein, but I have to. he came up with that eternal universe. He thought there was no beginning and no end. It had always been that way. Fortunately, Einstein was big enough to later say that was his biggest blunder he ever made, because he finally had to face the fact that Edwin Hubble measured in 1929 that there was a cosmic expansion. I won't go into detail how he measured that, but as long as we realize that there was a cosmic expansion, that means that the Earth had been a very tiny thing in space in the beginning, and it will expand and expand and expand. So he came up basically with that idea, but where came the idea from that this is expanding? Not from Fred Hoyle, not from Einstein, but from, as you said already, Father Lemaître.
Mm-hmm.
He was the priest from Belgium, so I'm a little biased. I'm from Holland, so I always feel close to him.
Right.
He was teaching at the French-speaking part of the University of Leuven or Louvain, and he came up with the idea that there was something like a Big Bang. Again, that word was not his; that came later from Fred Hoyle. So, actually, Albert Einstein was horrified when he heard that. He said, this is unbelievable. There is no way that that can be true. But, as I said already, he finally said, I made a big mistake. Father Lemaître was right. And so I have to say, and we have to be honest about everything, in 2018, the members of the International Astronomical Union voted overwhelmingly to recommend that the famous Hubble Law of Edwin Hubble in 1929 that described the expansion of the universe would from now on be called the Hubble-Lemaître Law.
Huh.
Ooh,
wow.
That is quite a compliment for Father Lemaître, Catholic, a priest. He, I'd like to quote one of his sayings where he says, I have no conflict to reconcile. You talked about a conflict before.
Yeah.
Science has not shaken my faith in religion, and religion has never caused me to question the conclusions I reached by scientific methods.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the end of the warfare myth, the end of the conflict theory. I hope you agree.
Yes, I was a real, again, when I was an undergraduate, there was still talk of it, but, in recent years, it seems to me, those who try to maintain this idea of a conflict between science and religion are not themselves historians of science. They're novelists, filmmakers, popular speakers, and there are a few adamant atheists who, for personal reasons, like to drive a wedge between science and faith, but you know, serious historians of science just don't do that.
No, but those atheists like to keep the conflict myth going and going and going.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you were talking about teachers, professors, and stuff like that. Many of them have never gotten that far yet. They are good scientists, but they never learned how to philosophize on it and how to see that there is a deeper dimension to life than that. So they keep, as I always say, they keep portraying that myth, and unfortunately, students are the victims.
You work in the field of genetics. Tell us a little bit about how genetics points to God. We also have an important Catholic figure in the history of genetics, too, with Gregor Mendel. But go ahead and tell us how genetics points to God.
Yeah, they call Mendel always the father of genetics. He was one of the first ones who worked with that kind of approach. And again, a priest, a monk. I don't really think he was a priest, but
I think you're right. Yeah,
an Augustinian monk.
That's right. I think you're right. Right.
Yeah. So he started the whole thing, and since then things have taken off quite a bit. It took 50 years before genetics really started to blossom, with genes, alleles, chromosomes, and stuff like that. But it is basically since 1953 that genetics really took off, because at that time the DNA molecule was unraveled.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA molecule has often been called the secret of life. Well, DNA is not a secret of life. DNA can't do anything on itself. If you put DNA in a test tube, it can't do anything.
Yeah.
It's like a dead piece of text that needs to be read and to make sense. A virus, and we are talking about viruses all the time nowadays, a virus even is not alive. It is a DNA or RNA molecule in a protein code. A coat.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs a cell to grow into. So viruses go into human cells, for instance, in the case of the China virus.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it goes into a bacteria or whatever. So they need the machinery of life, of a cell. So I would say the cell is the secret of DNA. DNA is not the secret of life.
Mm-hmm.
But still, DNA is powerful. It regulates the proteins we make in our body, and we all need proteins. Enzymes are proteins. So you cannot metabolize things if you don't have the right proteins. So that's why I can see that people say DNA is an important molecule. Yes, yes, yes. But it needs much more than DNA. It needs everything around it. So some have called DNA, it is a language of information.
Mm-hmm.
And information is not a chemical concept. There is no information in the molecule, basically. But DNA does have information. So where does that information come from?
Yeah.
The famous man who was in charge of the genome project, Collins, Francis Collins,
mm-hmm.
He was a very dedicated Christian. He was so Christian that when he was going to be assigned to that project, a lot of people protested, as they are doing now with a new chief justice, a potential chief justice. They say, how can a Christian, or let alone a Catholic, how can they be doing something for the government? Well, Francis Collins did. So he said, we have a code of God. It's the language of God, as he called it. And one of his books has that title.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice to read. I recommend it highly. I refer to it in my book, Pointers to God, Science Points to God. It points to God each time we have a new generation coming. We don't have to start everything from scratch, nor does God have to start everything from scratch. He uses the information of the DNA code to get us started. And So where does the DNA code from come from previous DNA? Yes, but it's also coming from God. Is that a conflict? Of course not.
Right.
God uses the DNA code just as he uses the laws of nature to make things happen in this world. So I always say children come through the laws of genetics and of DNA from their parents. But ultimately, they come from God. It doesn't make sense to create a conflict there. If I say they come from parents, that does not mean they cannot come from God. No. There is no conflict. There is no warfare there. It would be a conflict if I say they come from parents or they come from the stork. That's a conflict.
Right.
Either
right.
One is true. No, there is only one true. But you can come from parents and you can come from God. It is through the parents that God creates new human beings.
I want to return. I'm sorry, go right ahead.
Yeah, made in the image of God, as the book of Genesis says.
Yes.
We are all made in his image.
I want to go back to something you said earlier when you were talking about evolution, and that is this idea of randomness, which some people think of as pure chance. When it looks as though natural selection operates according to randomness, random according to who? In other words, doesn't the idea of randomness have a technical meaning in evolutionary studies? It doesn't mean the same kind of randomness that would displace God. Because, well, some people think of randomness, they think of, well, if it's random, it means God can have nothing to do with it. If it's pure chance, God can have nothing to do with it.
Correct, yeah. That's what they think.
Yeah.
But there is a big difference. You are right in saying that. So what I would like to just mention very briefly that Thomas Aquinas speaks of two kind of causes. The secondary causes are the causes we know from science. That is how molecules create new molecules, how DNA creates new DNA, etc. But there is all those causes can't do anything if there is no first cause. Well, randomness in science is a term that is very, very correct, very scientific. And it says something about how secondary causes cause other causes. That can sometimes be random. Even Thomas Aquinas says that there is chance in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also randomness that some people use as the ultimate ruler of life and of this universe. But then they are replacing God
right.
with a new deity.
That's right.
The deity of randomness, of chance. I always say that is chance with a capital C. Well, there is no chance with a capital C. Chance is just a scientific concept. And as Stephen Barr, who is a particle physicist,
mm-hmm.
I borrowed from him the important distinction. You could say I stole it from him, but I rather say I borrowed it from him. He said, randomness in science is how secondary causes cause each other.
Mm-hmm.
That can be random.
Yes.
But the randomness that some people talk about is about how are things related to God. And God is the ruler of everything. In the eyes of God, nothing is random.
Right.
God is all-knowing, all-present. He knows what is going to happen and what has happened, so there is nothing random in that sense.
Very good.
The people who confuse those two are basically making a big philosophical...
Dr. Verschuren, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Once again, great talking with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo. John chapter 11, verses 21 to 26. This is the story of Lazarus. Lazarus has died. Lazarus is one of his best friends. Just before this passage, we hear the news that Martha and Mary send word to Jesus that the one you love is sick. And the next line in the scripture is, now because Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, he stayed where he was. His friend's in need. He can heal. They've seen him heal before. And yet somehow, because he loves him, he stays. And Lazarus dies. And then Jesus shows up 3 days later and is greeted by Martha and Mary, who confront him with the words, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Rather applicable for many of us in our lives. We ask the Lord to do one thing because we're certain it is what we think is best, when in fact he has something which far surpasses what we asked for. The challenge is, in waiting for that to happen, we go through very trying times, which oftentimes makes us wonder, does he really care?
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me this first hour. And we will have, of course, follow-up information on the story I referred to in the first segment regarding Pope Francis and the new movie Francesco and this idea of civil unions. And we'll also have, of course, Gerard Verschuren's book, Science Points Us to God, available in the online bookstore. All you have to do is go to AveMariaRadio.net and go to the online bookstore, go to the Cresta Guest Archives, and you can get all you need there. Stay with me. We've got another great hour coming up.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for being here. In the second hour, we're talking about the things that matter most. Advent will be coming before we know it. And, of course, during Advent, we think a lot about the Nativity story, and we tell it and retell it to our children and our grandchildren. And we've all heard about sheep and cows and other barn animals who were present at Jesus' birth. But what about spiders? Raymond Arroyo imagines the scene through the eyes of a very small but very special spider that we're going to be looking at. He's put together an outstanding children's book with superb illustrations. So Raymond will be joining us a little bit later in this hour. And today, October 21st, we actually celebrate the feast of Blessed Charles I of Austria. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, well, I didn't know much about him either until I had the opportunity to look at this incredible book by Charles Colomb, which focuses in on the remarkable history of Blessed Charles I of Austria. This is the monarch during the, I think, 1916, right after the First World War began, deeply committed man to the faith, committed to his people. He wanted to He wanted to make major changes in the monarchy. Of course, he was frustrated and thwarted doing so. After the First World War, he had tried to be a peacemaker during the war, same as Benedict XV. Benedict XV had a plan. He was working to be an honest broker for peace. And Blessed Charles I of Austria was alongside him on that. We're going to talk with Charles Colomb a little bit later today about the saintly legacy of a holy emperor. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Alan. Good afternoon. With your Ave Maria Radio News headlines, I'm Matthew Handley. Today's Wednesday, October 21st, the Feast of Blessed Charles of Austria. The news this hour is sponsored by Visiting Angels, providing loving care to seniors in need. More info at visitingangels.com. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is slamming China for releasing a fact sheet that he says is a method to divert attention away from its own horrific environmental record.
The PRC is indeed responsible for an estimated 30% of plastic pollution on the world's oceans, more than any other country. The PRC is the world's largest consumer of illegal wildlife and timber products. Again, number one.
Speaking with reporters, Pompeo said that real data points are that China is the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gas, bar none. Pompeo also announced the department will designate six China-based media outlets as foreign missions. He said they will not place any restrictions on what any of these outlets can publish in the United States. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for parties in the conflict in Yemen to adhere to a ceasefire.
We need an immediate ceasefire and return to the negotiation table to work out a political settlement to end the war. Nothing less will suffice.
Guterres made the comments at a UN Security Council meeting yesterday. The war in Yemen began in late 2014. Over 112,000 people have died and more than 3 million people have become displaced. France is beginning a new effort to control Islamic extremism. Here's correspondent Bill Zinfer.
French President Emmanuel Macron says the country will step up its efforts to counter Islamic extremism. The comments came after the beheading of a teacher outside of Paris last week after he shows students cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. France's prime minister also said that the government will target all associations who have connections to radical Islamism. Bill Zimpfer, NBC News Radio.
And with your Ave Maria Radio News headlines, I'm Matthew Handley.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. As we enter into the, as we approach Advent, you know, we are getting towards the end of this year. We'll be focusing, of course, on the coming of Christ. We'll be talking about his first coming, be thinking of his second coming, and we'll hear many stories surrounding the Nativity. My guest, Raymond Arroyo, has just written an outstanding children's book called The Spider Who Saved Christmas. Many of you know Raymond, of course, as host of The World Over on EWTN. He's also a New York Times best-selling author. We've talked in the past about his Will Wilder children's series. He also has an outstanding biography of Mother Angelica. Raymond, you see probably fairly often on Fox News these days. He's also appeared on CNN and MSNBC. He's worked for the Associated Press. In fact, earned a Telly Award. And he's produced, written, and hosted a musical Christmas special for PBS, which is currently airing, called Christmas Time in New Orleans. Raymond, good to have you back here.
Oh, Al, it's always a pleasure to be with you. How have you been?
I'm doing fine. How about you? You look awfully busy. I see you often, and you sound like you're running.
I am awfully busy.
Yeah.
I agree. It's par for the course. But, you know, this it's odd how this Spider Who Saved Christmas picture book came about. I was actually researching something in a forthcoming Will Wilder book, and I was flipping through one of these old great Bible commentaries, big fat one, and in the gospel narratives, in the footnote, there was a reference to this legend, and it concerned the flight to Egypt. You know, St. Joseph has the dream, go to Egypt and take the child and his mother with you. What happened is I read this little legend that was in the footnote. It was only a sentence or two, and that got me on the trail of this legend that I had never heard before.
Yeah.
And we see remnants of this legend every Christmas, Al. It's in the Christmas tinsel that we decorate trees with. All that glittery tinsel is a connection, an homage almost, to this story. And somehow, we've forgotten this legend and this story, and it just isn't told with any regularity. I'd never heard it before.
No, I haven't
either. So I went back and dug around. It was centuries old, and it is the story of a spider in a cave that encounters Mary and Joseph and Jesus as they fly toward Egypt from Bethlehem. And it ends up being about much more than that in my telling. I, you know, rounded it out.
Sure.
It's a very sparse tale. But I loved what it said to me, and it allowed me a chance to sort of meditate and delve into this moment in the Christmas story that we often forget, which is you have a family in tension and in anxiety and worry, which I dare say during Christmas time or any other time, most families can relate to more than, you know, stars in the skies and you know, three kings coming to visit your child. We can all relate to worrying sure. about each other and anxieties. And though I wrote it a year and a half ago, and it is a beautiful picture book, and it's for kids and families and really for anybody because it speaks to different ages, I'm finding out. It speaks to us in this particular moment, I think, Al, which is something I never intended when I started this project.
It has it reminds us in the midst of the chaos that we're currently undergoing and the threats we have to our cohesion as a nation, as a family, that there is something that we can continue to hope, rest our hopes on. Your title, the name of the spider here is Nephilia. Is that from the legend itself, or did you pull that name?
No, that's my creation.
Yeah,
In the legend, it just says a spider. You know, they came across this spider, and the spider has a very pivotal role in this particular story.
Right.
And you know, she it's a dramatic moment. You know, this family is being hunted. Their child, the Christ child, is being hunted by Herod's men. They're on the run. And but I needed a character. I needed to flesh out who this character is, as well as the Holy Family, whom, you know, Al, we all, from the time we're children to adulthood, we start to confine these people, these saints, these true figures, to Fontanini characters under the tree or somebody in our Advent calendar.
Yeah.
What I love about The Spider Who Saved Christmas is it's getting kids to ask the right questions as they go through the story. And I've heard this from parent after parent after parent and grandparents whom I've you know, sent early copies of the books to. The story pulls them in, and because I created this character, Nephila, and she's a golden orb weaver. Now, that breed of spider is particular to the Middle East, Africa, South America. But they spin a very rare silk. It's a golden silk. And I thought, if Jesus is going to encounter a spider, why not the most important and granddaddy of all spiders? So we you know, it's a beautiful, they almost have mother of pearl backs with, you know, flecks of gold and color in them. They're beautiful spiders. I mean, I get that, you know, people are scared of spiders. Some people are frightened by them. My spider is rather lovable. So Nephila is a mother herself protecting her children from her own home invasion when Joseph and Mary come in. And you see the fear, you know, that I think we all have in this moment. In the open of the book, you know, St. Joseph drives his staff through her web and tries to kill the spider because, you know, who wants a big spider hanging around your child and your wife? And the Blessed Mother stays his hand and says, let it be. All of us are here for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that theme ends up coloring the rest of this story and really setting the narrative in motion. But I loved this particular breed of spider. I later found out that Nephila, my spider, is related to Charlotte in the famous E.B. White story.
Really?
Charlotte is a regular orb weaver. She's not a golden orb weaver, but is a regular orb weaver. So there's a kind of interesting familial connection there. So you needn't be afraid of all spiders, especially when they're confined to picture books. So
very nice.
I always tell people who are a little squirrely about the spiders.
And this is beautifully illustrated, too. And tell me a little bit about Randy Galagos.
Randy Galagos has primarily done fantasy covers, you know, sci-fi and kind of fantasy covers for books. And I was impressed that he had a sense of realism, but there was a supernatural dimension, if you will, to the edges of his work. And I thought, you know, he'll be able to do this. We went through like three illustrators, I have to tell you, Al.
Wow.
And I am, this is the first book that I kind of artistically directed. You know, I normally just, you know, that in the Will Wilder books, they had a whole department that did that.
Right.
This one I kind of took in hand. So it was neat to work with Randy on every, you know, spread. And we were very determined that it be dynamic. So it ends up having a very cinematic quality, and Randy's eye is just brilliant. He, from the sketches to the final illustrations, every image had movement and life and passion and color. He surpassed even what I imagined for the project.
Beautiful.
But it really does pull you in, and children and families love the illustrations. And, you know, I it was very important to me because it being a picture book, 90% of the first thing people encounter are the pictures.
Right.
But for this classic story to breathe, it needed a old world classic feel in the illustration.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want a modern or a cartoony feel
right.
in here. And Randy captured that. All of these paintings were done by hand. They look like something from an old master. And the colors are rich and deep and give it that. It gives it a classic ancient feel while feeling new and urgent. And that's what we were after here.
Yeah, the story certainly is fresh. And I was surprised you might point out near the close of the book that Poles, Ukrainians, and other Eastern Europeans have a tradition of placing spider ornaments on Christmas trees.
Yes.
I had no idea.
They do, and they're very sought after. I've seen them as I've traveled in Eastern Europe at Christmas time. You see them, and I didn't know what they were. I just thought, oh, well, somebody decided to put a spider ornament in a tree. Who thinks of tinsel? I always thought the tinsel was just like frost, you know, icicles.
Right.
You know, those were to represent icicles hanging from the tree. Well, no, it is a reference to this story, and it's where this tradition evolved. It came from this particular story and the spider who saved Christmas. So I don't want to ruin the story for people,
right.
here's the thing that, you know, when you start a story, Al, and people always tell me, you know, how do you start? You know, how do you figure this out? And you really don't. You're drawn to a subject or a topic or a kernel of a story, and then you have to live with it a little bit, and then eventually the story takes over. And then it speaks to you and tells you why you got involved in the first place. And looking back, I now realize part of the reason I was drawn to this, certainly the supernatural dimension of this drew me in, and the fact that you had a legend that was embedded in the greatest story ever told, it fills in a neat little crack in the scripture. This is a little part of the story that, frankly, is silent. The scripture is silent on. So we don't know what happened to them as they fled between Bethlehem
right,
and Egypt.
Right.
This tells us, this fills in that little gap. And the other nice piece of it is for us contemporaneously. It made me think as I reread it and when I saw the final product, we're all like this family this Christmas. We are, in many ways, hiding in our caves, trying to stave off death that's just outside the door.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing we have to realize is God doesn't abandon us, and hope is always present. And grace often comes through very common instruments, even frightening creatures or things we don't consider or don't necessarily want around us. Sometimes those are the vehicles of grace in our midst, but hope is always there as long as you keep yourself open to it and have the faith to see it.
Amen.
That's what's at the heart of this story, I think.
And it's Mary's words, all are here for a reason, let it be. Really, that's the pivot for the story.
Yeah.
So
it is.
Yeah.
It is. And it opens up the rest of the tale. And you know, the spider really, small though she is, frightened though she is, afeared though she is, she has her role to play in all of this, as we all do. And I think for children, that's such a great and important message that, you know, don't think your role in the grand scheme of life or in the life of your family is insignificant or unimportant, it could be the most important thing. Yeah. And, you know, a friend asked me the other day, well, how does this connect to your other works? And I said, well, it's just, it's not unlike Mother Angelica or Will Wilder. You have dismissed figures who are sort of pushed to the sidelines, ignored, and they end up being the most important person.
Yeah.
And pivotal to a good outcome. And that's what happens here in The Spider Who Saved Christmas and in all those books.
The stones that the builder rejected became the cornerstone. Raymond, thanks so much. Great talking with you.
Thank you, Al.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that his Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes him at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
How would you define the word beatitude? Webster's Dictionary defines beatitude as a state of utmost bliss and a declaration made in the Sermon on the Mount. The Catechism of the Catholic Church states that the Beatitudes are, in effect, a portrait of the man who declared them, Jesus Christ, depicting his countenance and portraying his charity. The Beatitudes also describe the attitudes and actions that should portray and depict his followers, true Christians. The Beatitudes are paradoxical in their promises. None seems more paradoxical than number 8, which proclaims, "Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." The paradox is that God is present even amidst trials and tribulations. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Religious freedom and healthcare and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Did you know you were kicking in your mommy's tummy before you were born?
We were?
Yep, I just learned at school that babies move and kick before they're even born.
No wonder we're so good at soccer.
Hello, I'm Marian Kuharski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We know that conversations about right to life have become very heated, even angry. We stay away from that political fray. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options. We're here to help both mom and the baby, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Please call 1-800-366-7773. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception. Pro-Life Across America, the billboard people.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. October 21st is the feast of Blessed Charles I of Austria. sometimes called Blessed Carl, but he's known by other names due to his succession. Now, in America, we generally don't think much about kings or queens or royalty. We have kind of a secularized view of royalty, and it's not very doesn't have much of the pageantry that we associate with European monarchs. And so I venture to say that many of us don't even know Blessed Charles of Austria. But according to those of his advocates, he was in fact a holy emperor. He had an extraordinary legacy and in fact should be eventually canonized. My guest, Charles Coulomb, is one of North America's most respected and sought-after commentators on culture, religion, history, and politics. He's a specialist in the history and government of the Catholic Church, and he's also a member of the Knights of Peter Claver. Currently studying theology at the International Theological Institute in Truman, Austria, and the author of Blessed Charles of Austria, A Holy Emperor and His Legacy. And Charles, it's good to have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
What a, this is a topic that I will, I think, is you probably are well aware. Many of us know nothing about. So, I mean, tell me a little bit. Why don't we start with the easy things? Give me his dates, would you?
Sure. The emperor was born in 1880. Oh, my! I just had a blur.
It happens to me too.
Yeah, it's I'm older now than he got to be, so you see, I'm a little out of it. But no, he died in 1922. The centennial is coming up,
And he was in his 30s, right, when he died?
Yes, early 30s. He was 32, I think.
Okay,
and he was active emperor for only 2 years.
Okay,
inheriting World War I from his great uncle, the old emperor Franz Joseph. And from the very moment he became emperor, he tried to do two things, in both of which he was unable to succeed. One was to bring about peace, which nobody else except Pope Benedict XV at the time was interested in. And the other was to restructure the monarchy on a federal basis, a more equitable basis than it had been. And unfortunately for Europe and for us, actually, when you think about World War II,
right,
he didn't succeed in either one.
Right, right. Now, so he succeeded to the throne during the First World War, is that right?
That's correct, 1916.
Okay.
His great-uncle, who was the old emperor, died.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not actually, when he was born, he was not the heir to the throne by a long shot. There were a lot of people between him and the throne.
Really?
And he wasn't expected to succeed. But one by one, they died. And the last of them was his uncle, his father's brother, Franz Ferdinand, who, as you know, was murdered at Sarajevo, which
right,
is what kicked off the First War.
Yeah, that's right. That was his uncle. Okay.
Yes, the brother of his father.
So, tell me a little bit about his upbringing and how he would have been. I guess what I'm looking for is, would he have been groomed to become a Catholic monarch? Was it understood that the monarchy and the faith worked together in some, you know, indivisible way?
Very, very definitely. For the Habsburgs and for other royal families like the Bourbon, the Savoy, and so on, being a monarch, being a king or an emperor, was as much a vocation as being a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And like being a priest, it required certain sacrifices. It required very much a lack of freedom of the sort that private individuals can expect. But that was considered to be part of the job, to be part of the holy calling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very definitely seen as a holy calling. The House of Habsburg had a species of devotion peculiar to itself that they called the Pietas Austriaca, the Austrian piety.
Huh.
And it was very big on the rosary devotion to the Passion, the Blessed Sacrament, the Sacred Heart. Now, obviously, there are a lot of Habsburgs, and some of them took it more seriously than others.
Sure.
But Kaiser Karl, from the very beginning, took it very, very seriously. Now, he was born into a kind of an unpleasant situation, however, and that is that his father, the Archduke Otto, was a really, really enjoyable fellow, lots of fun, but kind of a ne'er-do-well.
Okay.
And he really, let's just say that he and Karl's very devout mother were not very well suited to each other. She was a Saxon princess and very, very pious, very devout. But one of the interesting things about Karl is that even though his parents were not well matched and didn't get along at all after a while, he took the best from both of them and stayed on good terms with both of them. So he had his father's easy charm, his humor, his way of seeing all sides of a situation. That is why his father was so endearing to so many people, no matter what he did. But he didn't have any of the promiscuity or the other things.
Okay.
And then he had his mother's very, very deep devotion, very real devotion, in addition to his inherited practices. But he didn't have his mother's dourness. You know, she was a very, very serious woman. You can imagine why those two really didn't get along.
Yes. She would have probably held her husband in contempt for his merriment. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And he thought, he actually called her the nun. So, you know, this was not a couple who were well suited. But, and this is one of the things that hit me actually toward the end of writing the book, we look at Karl as a very good example of a father, of a husband, of a ruler, and actually of a soldier. He was all those things. He was very good at all. But he was also a wonderful patron for people from bad families, broken homes, because he'd been through it and yet managed, A, to stay on good terms with both of his parents, even when they ended up living apart. And he managed to get the best from both of them. And this would stand him in very, very good stead, because his uncle, who was the heir to the throne before 1914, he had done what is called a morganatic marriage. And what that means is that he had married a woman whom a Habsburg was not supposed to marry.
Mm-hmm. This from a lower class, the price, then?
Yeah, she was a noblewoman, but she wasn't royal.
Yeah, okay.
So, as a result, his children could not inherit the throne.
Hmm.
Now, stop and think about that for a second. You'd have to be almost a saint yourself not to resent the nephew who's going to take your children's place.
Right, right.
And yet, he didn't. Now, part of it was because, as I discovered in doing my research, Franz Ferdinand was a really great fellow himself.
I see.
But it was also the fact that Karl went out of his way not to be a problem, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
He knew how to work with him. And you see, the other thing that was interesting about this whole tense situation that he was born into was that because of the morganatic marriage, his great uncle, the emperor, and his uncle, the heir, they weren't on good terms either.
Hmm.
And they had differing political visions for the empire.
I see.
So, to everyone's great surprise, Karl was able to get on very well with both of them. And my suspicion is that it's because of his experience with his parents.
Yes, because he had opposites he had to deal with there. And he had developed some skills.
Precisely. And opposites he loved.
Yes, you know, that's right.
The key to understanding Emperor Karl in his personal relationships, in his political views, in everything, and this is going to sound sort of mawkish, but I have no other answer for it, is love.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even on his deathbed, his peoples, who had caused him no end of pain, and not just his difficulties with governing them, but their hatred of each other, because the empire he inherited was made up of 9 or 10 or 11 different nationalities,
mm-hmm.
most of whom couldn't stand one another. Well, and the funny thing is, they worked very well as a unit, which only now are people beginning to realize, but they were very difficult to govern in tandem and to govern justly. So and a lesser man, I think, considering everything he was ended up being put through, would have gone to his death hating them. But one of his last words on his very, very unpleasant deathbed were, "I am suffering that my people should come back together."
Interesting. So he saw his suffering as redemptive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He did indeed. And he offered it up.
Very good.
Not only for his family, but for all the peoples of his empire.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking that it's very difficult for us today to conceive of that kind of leadership.
It is. I mean, it's very difficult at a number of different levels here. He was obviously somebody who was able to see the find value in differences, as you point out, going back to his parents. He was able to see value in and loved both of them, and they were in fact very different people. He is being groomed, or is grooming himself, to become monarch of an empire, which is going to which does contain 9 or 10 different people groups, and so he's got to have show appreciation for the backgrounds, the cultures, dialects of all these groups. I would imagine he was well educated to get to know.
He was indeed. He was very well educated. And he went to the Schottenstift, which is a even today a very good school in originally Irish monks in Vienna. And he went to the University of Prague, and he had a great deal of military schooling as well. He was very good with languages, very good with history and geography, which all of which he had to be. And one of the interesting things about him, though, has to do with his early schooling. He was about 5. The organization that is overseeing his canonization, as it did his beatification, the prayer league piece for Emperor Karl, the Gebetsliga.
Tell you what, Charles, hold it there if you would for a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We'll come back and pick it up from there. Looking at Charles I of Austria, blessed.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
You know, maybe we need to ask ourselves, do we really know Jesus? Maybe another way to ask that would be, how familiar are you with the Gospels?
When I was living in D.C., I was on the plane taking a late flight home, sitting next to a young girl. She was probably 16, 17. I had my collar on, and we got talking, and she said somehow in the course of the conversation, she acknowledged that she was running away from home and was in the midst of an awful lot of difficulties that were going on. Her story seemed to be remarkably akin to the story of the prodigal son, which we just heard this past Sunday at Mass, huh? And so I started to speak a little bit about that with her. And I said, you sound a little bit like the younger son in the story of the prodigal son. And she looked at me like I was from Mars. And I said, are you not familiar with the story of the prodigal son? And she says, no, never heard it. And I just looked at her and I says, oh my goodness, are you in for a wonderful evening?
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Is your teen struggling with self-criticism, poor motivation, or bad eating or sleeping habits? Does he or she tend to isolate, have bouts of anger, or struggle in their academic or social life? If you've said yes to at least a few of these statements, your teen might be dealing with clinical depression. According to Johns Hopkins University, adolescent depression rates increased by 37% in the last decade. Many parents assume that depressed mood and behavior are a normal part of a teenager's life. While every teen has some struggles with self-image or peer relationships, when those struggles become a consistent cross, it's time to seek professional help. Depression isn't something your kids will grow out of, but with appropriate help, it is something they can learn to leave behind for good. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We are looking over the life and the saintly legacy of Charles I of Austria, Blessed Charles of Austria. My guest, Charles Coulomb, is the author of Blessed Charles of Austria, A Holy Emperor and His Legacy. And when we were going into the break, we were talking about his education and his ability to understand the 9 or 10 different people groups that he was ultimately to govern. And go ahead, if you would, Charles, pick it up from there.
Well, it was kind of an interesting thing. But when he was 5 or 6 years old, his father was in the army still and was posted to a town called Udenburg. Today at Sopron, it's in Hungary. And his parents and he were living there. Now, as I began to mention, the Gebetsliga, the prayer league for Emperor Karl, is kind of unique amongst most organizations of its sort. That is to say, organizations that look to get an individual beatified or canonized. Because usually what happens with them is that they're founded after the person dies. They've got a reputation of holiness, people are very intrigued by them and so on. But the Gebetsliga actually was begun when Karl himself was 5 or 6 years old.
Really?
Yes. Huh. It's a very strange story. As I say, they were living in Udenburg, Sopron, and there was a Benedictine monk who was to teach little Karl, as he was then, his catechism. Well, the priest had a friend who was an Ursuline nun. On the one hand, she was the superior of the local convent and head of the principal of the Ursuline school. But she was also a stigmatic.
Huh. Wow.
Mother Vincenzia. And she was, she had, amongst those who knew, she had a reputation for prophecy. Now, at this stage in his life, he was not expected to succeed to the throne. Emperor Franz Joseph's son was very much alive, married, could have an heir. His uncle, Franz Ferdinand, was older than his father. He was next in line. He hadn't married yet, but he was very likely to, and they didn't know that he was going to marry morganatically. So you see, the likelihood of his coming to the throne was remote at that time in his life. So his catechist, this Benedictine, tells his friend, Mother Vincentia, about his little, the little Archduke that he's teaching. And she says, he will be Emperor of Austria one day.
Wow.
And he will be a gift to the country because of all that Austria has done for the faith. But hell will open itself up against him. So you've got to get people to start praying for the little boy now.
Yeah, fascinating.
And they did.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of the Gebetsliga. And by the when he died, it had been functioning from that time on. There was a whole circle of people praying for him. And when he died, they reorganized and began pressing for his beatification, mm-hmm. which came true finally in 2004. And interestingly enough, he got married to a very interesting lady in her own right. She was a Bourbon princess. Her mother was a Portuguese princess, so she was of French, Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese descent, all of Western Europe in one woman. And she was as devout as he was. She came from a very different background in a lot of ways, but she was just as devout. And after they got married, Carl said to her, "Now we must help each other get to heaven."
Mm.
Well, they had 8 children, and most of them during the war. One of them was conceived actually while they were in exile, which shows you that they didn't let their terrible circumstances get in the way of their family life.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died, she was pregnant with the 8th child.
Wow.
Okay. But she lived until 1989. Her name was Zita of Bourbon Parma. And she's a servant of God herself. She's up for beatification. And the interesting thing about that is that his feast day, and if it'll be theirs if she's beatified, is not his death day, which was April 1st. It's their wedding day.
Huh, really? Well, that's fascinating,
yep.
too.
It is.
And she's currently a servant of God, right?
She's a servant of God,
yeah.
And presuming that she's beatified one day, they'll surely have a joint feast day.
Feast day. That's what I was just thinking. Yeah, no, that would be beautiful. That would just be beautiful.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about his attitude towards the First World War. It's often said that the First World War was irrational, unnecessary. There wasn't a participant in it that was without guilt. What was his attitude towards the First World War and his country's participation in it? Because he served in the military, right, during the war.
He certainly did.
Yeah.
He was one of the very, very few wartime leaders that actually served at the front. And in fact, on one occasion on the Italian front, there was a flash flood, and this is, I think, before he became emperor. But there was a flash flood, and he jumped into the torrent and saved this disabled soldier who had been swept away.
Wow!
At great risk to his own life. But that was him. I mean, everyone knew that he was quite brave physically.
Was he beloved by his men? Did they like him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, very much so. And again, because he shared their difficulties, he shared their dangers, even though he was a general officer during the war, he was always at the front. And in fact, at several fronts, because while his great uncle was still alive, he would use him as a sort of confidential informant to see how things were going on, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So as a result, he didn't stay behind the lines and listen to what the staff officers had to tell him. He went up to the front to see for himself what was going on so he could report back to his uncle, or great uncle Ralph.
Yeah. Okay.
But to answer your question, he was very much opposed to war. His uncle, Franz Ferdinand, had not only wanted to federate the empire, he also was not happy about what he considered to be Austria's over-dependence on Germany. And had opened up just as heir to the throne in the years before 1914, had opened up certain personal avenues toward Russia and England with a view, presumably, to lessening Austria's dependence on Germany, which he was afraid, if it came to a war, would turn Austria into a German satellite, which in the end is what happened.
That's exactly what happened.
And he passed on these fears to his nephew. Carl was very, very much against the war. He was a pacifist in the way only a real soldier can be.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people for whom it's all theoretical. It wasn't for him. And mind you, he was very much for defeating the enemy if that's what was required.
Mm-hmm.
But to do so as quickly as possible and with as little damage to either side as possible. So what happened was that when he became emperor, he was often in conflict with his German allies, but they had the upper hand. So, for instance, when they talked to him about unconditional submarine warfare, he said, don't do it. If you do this, it'll bring in the United States, and then there's no chance of winning.
Right.
Well, of course, he was a kid. He didn't know what he was talking about. Ludendorff and Hindenburg were wise old men. They knew. They were blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what?
Yep.
Then they came up with another bright idea. Let's knock Russia out of the war. We've got this fellow called Lenin. What we'll do is we'll put him in a sealed train. We'll send him to Russia, and he'll cause all sorts of problems. And then that'll knock Russia out of the war. But Carl said, no, that's not a very good idea.
Oh, my.
What this guy has to preach is poison, and not only will it be bad for Russia, it'll come back on us. Well, he couldn't stop the Germans from doing it, but what he did do was forbid Lenin to be sent to Austrian territory, which was the original plan.
Oh,
really? And the other thing he did, what's that?
They were going to send Lenin through Austrian territory?
They wanted to. He stopped them. He couldn't stop them from doing it because they took no notice. But he could stop them from sending him to Austrian territory.
Interesting.
Which is what happened?
Okay, so he goes to Finland.
I found out just this week. I have to warn you: if you ever write books, you'll always find stuff after they come out that you wish you'd done.
I know.
Yes, it's the rule. Every book I've ever written, it's happened to me, and it's happening now. I found out that there had been a similar plan to send revolutionaries to Italy. And because the only way they could get them there was through Austrian territory, that he was able to stop.
Interesting. Very good.
And so the Italians, even though they were his primary foes next to the Russians, they actually owe him a lot. But to be fair, the Italian king, Victor Emmanuel III, he was the only other leader other than Karl and King Albert of the Belgians who was actually on the front line.
Interesting. Let me ask you about Pope Benedict XV then. He was generally considered he wanted to be an honest broker. He had a peace plan. Blessed Charles, being the devout Catholic that he was, how did he relate to Pope Benedict XV's proposed peace plan?
Completely.
Okay.
Totally. It would be hard to describe anyone more anxious to get it into practice than he was.
Wow.
And of course, he negotiated privately with the French for peace. But the problem that plagued him was that when things were going well for the Allies, they weren't interested in peace. And when things were going well for the Central Powers, they weren't interested in peace.
Yeah.
So, because both sides just wanted to win. And Karl was of the opinion that there really was no victory, quote unquote, to be had, just piles of corpses.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then he'd seen them, which was not the case of people like Clemenceau or Wilson or Lloyd George.
That's right.
So, he carried on these secret negotiations with the French, which didn't go anywhere, primarily because at the end of the day, he would have had to have concluded a separate peace and desert his ally.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been very, very difficult. And unfortunately, although he alerted Kaiser Wilhelm to the fact that he was undergoing negotiations without giving him details, Wilhelm did not mention this to the two generals who were now really ruling Germany, Hindenburg and Ludendorff.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
What happened was that when Briand, the decent fellow on the French side, was replaced by the evil Clemenceau, Clemenceau saw fit after a speech by Carl's rather incompetent foreign minister, Chernin, to reveal to the world that Carl had attempted to negotiate for peace.
Wow.
And this, in turn, provoked a huge kickback on the part of the German generals,
yeah,
who had not known anything about it.
Right. Unfortunately,
it was.
We're out of time. Unfortunately, I hope we can get together again on this. This is a very new topic for me, and I greatly appreciate you being with me today, Charles. Thank you.
No, I'm very, very happy to be able to do it. He's a grand character, and I'm glad to make it better now any way I can.
Thank you. We'll talk again. The book is called Blessed Charles of Austria, A Holy Emperor and His Legacy by Charles Coulomb, available, of course, in the online bookstore.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
There is a time for everything under heaven.
As moral agents, we exist in a universe that allows us to move in three space and one time dimensions called space-time. The paradox in which God has placed us allows us complete freedom of movement through the space dimensions, but we are constrained to move in only one direction through time. That irony of freedom and constraint forces upon us the natural law of causation. For every moral action we take in space, a moral consequence is delivered in time. In space, we can go forward or backward. But why, oh why, can't we go back in time and fix things? We really have no idea, but God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon, and thank you for being with me over the last 2 hours. Let me tell you again that you can find all the books that we discuss on this program available in the online bookstore at AveMariaRadio.net. So Blessed Charles I of Austria will be there. We'll also have The Spider Who Saved Christmas there. And Gerard Verschuren's book from the first hour, Science Points Us to God, will be there. Also, you can go to the Cresta Guest Archives and locate articles, websites, blogs, Twitter information, Facebook information for our guests, so you can follow up, contact with them of one sort or another, and also articles that were used in preparation for the interviews. Just again, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Lord willing, I'll see you tomorrow.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.